Okay, well, I hope everyone is well rested for a new and exciting day. My name is Raul Romaguera, and I am the Associate Director for Policy in the Division of STD Prevention at the CDC. This morning, we're going to continue exploring the issues related to the theme of the conference of maximizing impact, efficiencies, and return of investments. Our two distinguished speakers are going to address and explore some examples of quality improvement programs, and we'll apply those to STD prevention in the United States. Our first speaker this morning is Dr. Pierre Barker. He's Senior Vice President for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He is responsible for IHI's large-scale health systems improvement initiatives outside of the U.S. Dr. Barker attended medical school in South Africa and trained in pediatrics in the U.K. and the U.S. Before joining IHI, he was medical director of the University of North Carolina's Children's Hospital Clinics, and he was responsible for leading systems-wide initiatives on improving access to care and chronic disease management. Our second speaker this morning is Dr. Stefano Bertozzi. He is the Dean and Professor of Health Policy and Management at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Previously, he directed the HIV and Tuberculosis Program at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He serves on the scientific advisory boards for the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the National Institute of Health Office of AIDS Research, and the WHO HIV program. Dr. Bertozzi worked at the Mexican National Institute of Public Health as director of its Center for Evaluation, Research, and Surveys, and has also led positions with UNAIDS and the World Bank. He holds a bachelor's degree in biology and a PhD in health policy and management from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He earned his medical degree at UC San Diego and trained in internal medicine at UC San Francisco. So let's welcome our two speakers.
Good morning. And thank you very much for inviting me. I wanted to start with a disclaimer, which is which you've heard, that I'm a pediatrician. I'm not a STD expert. I'm not a public health expert. And I do most of my work outside the United States. But I think I share with you a deep interest in how we take evidence and apply it to populations that need it at scale. And that's what I'll be talking about this morning. And I also think that there is much that we can learn from what's happening outside the United States, some of the programming that I've been involved with, which is very germane to some of the issues that we're grappling with STDs in the United States, and also helping us to think about how we might adapt some of those large-scale programming issues to the changing health environment with what's happening with the Affordable Care Act. So I wanted to take us first to South Africa in 1994. 1994 was a very momentous time for South Africa, the end of centuries of oppression, colonialism, and injustice. And what you see here is people celebrating the opportunity to vote for the first time. This was personally for me a very exciting moment. It was also the first time that I chose to vote. The South African embassy had fortunately arranged for South Africans living in the Raleigh area to vote, and so I was able to turn up. A very exciting moment. But what the people standing in that sun did not realize, and I think to be fair to the leaders of South Africa, did not appreciate either for a while, was that the HIV epidemic was about to hit the country. From virtually no HIV recorded in antenatal clinics in 1990, by the turn of the century, one in four mothers turning up to antenatal clinics were HIV positive, and by 2005 that was one in three, and that has remained since then. I don't have to remind this audience that by 2000 there were good options for pregnant mothers with HIV. Untreated mother-to-child transmission rates are about 25%, as you know. The first treatments that were available were single-dose nevirapine, which cut that in half, And of course, now with multi-drug options, we're virtually able to eliminate the transmission of HIV from mother to child. The South African government program was launched in early 2003, and the first impact study, which was done in 2007, testing mothers back in 2005, showed that 21% of mothers were still transmitting the virus from their baby to the infant, so showing virtually no impact of the South African program. Now remember that by this time, nevirapine was available widely in all of the clinics, standard protocols were available, and the nurses were all trained around the thousands of clinics in the public system to deliver a treatment. Dual therapy was introduced in 2008, and you can see the next impact study done in 2008 showed a transmission rate of 8.5%. What I really want to talk about is what happened subsequently, which is quite extraordinary. The transmission rate came down and has come down to around about 2% where it is today. An absolutely phenomenal achievement by the South African health system. And what I want to talk a little bit about is what actually lay behind that and what lessons we might take to some of the challenges that we face with STDs today. So the rapid and unexpected rise of HIV in the 90s I think caught everybody by surprise, and I think it explains a lot of the behavior of the South African government in response to the epidemic, which initially was one of a denial. And it took the South African people themselves, who had been very involved in overthrowing the previous regime, to understand that unless they were going to get back out on the street, that their freedom was certainly being threatened by the HIV epidemic. And so what you see here is a demonstration outside the AIDS conference, which took place in 2000, where people really demanded that the South African government provide treatment for PMTCT. And the second intervention was a widespread opposition to drug companies who were insisting on patent rights. There's a big struggle in the courts, and again, people took to the streets, and that battle was then won. A very nice description of this miracle of the South African PMTCT program is described by Peter Barron, who described the events that really led to this remarkable program in South Africa. And the first two events, as I said, were persuading the government, first of all, to allow treatment, and secondly, to overcome the resistance from the drug companies. And in 2002, the first national PMTCT program was launched. In 2008, dual therapy plus highly active antiretroviral therapy was introduced. And in 2008, the government launched what was called the Accelerated Plan to Reduce Mother-to-Child Transmission, a pivotal turning point that I'll talk a little bit more about. In 2009, the president addressed the scale of the problem for the first time, and we'll talk about the importance of that kind of symbolic act. And then South Africa then fell in line and has subsequently adopted all the new WHO guidelines that have come into play. And the point about showing this really is to indicate the variety and the complexity of what it would take to really get on top of a national problem of the scale of HIV, which includes the medical evidence, advocacy, policy, and very importantly, health systems intervention. And it's that health systems intervention at a national scale and the planning for it that I wanted to just spend a few moments on. We were very fortunate to be involved in a demonstration project in KwaZulu province in South Africa, involving three southern districts of that province, population of 5.5 million, over 200 primary care clinics and 18 hospitals. And the project had a very specific aim. Could we decrease mother-to-child transmission from the rates? The impact study had just come out showing 21%. What would it take to get it down to 5%? And we knew that dual therapy was coming, so we had the tools to do it, but could the system do it? We knew that the system was failing at that point. We focused on the events that were happening inside the clinic, because in South Africa, and this is very relevant to the STD clinic, the STD issues in this country, because in South Africa, women come to the clinic. So they come for antenatal care and for skilled delivery. So we were able to focus on the three key issues to ensure safe delivery of the mother-child transmission program, which included screening and testing, treatment and verification. Here are the results from those three districts, and what you'll see is the hallmark of a quality improvement intervention, which is that we had data. The data that we had was not great, but we had real-time data coming in from 200 clinics and 18 hospitals that we were able to track, give us a good indication about how well or badly the program was working. So the project was launched in early 2008. You see an initial bump in two of the districts started off at around 60%. One was already performing at 100%. The beauty about that is that we also, in the quality improvement system, we had a learning system which allowed us to learn from the district that was doing well and bring that information into the two districts that were struggling. That bump initially that you see in 2008 turned out to be fictitious. It had to do with data issues. We re-looked at our data a year later, and again, the key issue about this program is that we were able to constantly re-evaluate our data real-time and make changes. Nobody came with a master plan at the beginning of the program. We were able to make changes after the first 12 months that you can see resulted in significant increases in testing rates of HIV in those two districts that were falling behind. And then have been sustained following withdrawal of support from those districts. This is the hallmark of a very large program that happened purely in the public clinic system, over 200 clinics. This is aggregate data from those clinics and hospitals. Here are the measured mother-child transmission rates measured at 6 weeks in infants. When they came back to the clinic, and you can see progressive decline in transmission rates. And I want to make a really clear point here about the fact that it wasn't just the quality improvement intervention that was responsible for this. There were a few important factors. This program was done collectively with the NGO partners that we were supporting, as well as very closely with the Department of Health, who were able to make policy changes. And one of the most important policy changes was a task shift that allowed nurses for the first time to dispense antiretrovirals. So these factors together led to the rapid decline in mother-to-child transmission rates across the three districts. The information that we gathered from this demonstration project and from others around was absolutely invaluable. This is a what we called tried and tested. This is a collection of the ideas that came from the front line that allowed that rapid improvement to happen. But they were not just ideas. They were ideas from the front line that had been actually tested and verified with data to show that they actually worked. This is gold dust. This is the antithesis of trying to plan out a program from your office, because these are highly context-sensitive interventions that allow us to make the transition, to cross the divide from efficacy to effectiveness. Hugely important, and it was this that gave the government confidence, having seen that demonstration, to be able to put together what they called the accelerated plan, which was to take the ideas from this demonstration and from others around and to apply it to a very well-designed, rapidly moving national plan that would apply this implementation evidence to the other provinces, starting initially with testing in another five districts and then moving through the country in 2010. And the result is that the South African system was able to protect 1.4 million mothers who are pregnant every year in South Africa. At least 0.4 million of them are known to have HIV. They were able to, at very, very high rates of reliability, 95% of these women were able to be tested, and 95% of them treated. An extraordinary achievement, and I actually don't think there's another example of a national program implemented through a public system at a primary care level that reached the levels of effectiveness that you can see in under clinical trial conditions. So the question is, what does it take to close a performance gap like this on a national scale? And I think the first is a change in the conversation. South Africa was faced with the reality that they had seen a decline in survival rates and life expectancy for the first time since records began. And it wasn't just a decline, it was a 20% decline in life expectancy. So there was no getting away from the fact that this epidemic was robbing South Africa of basically of its future. And it galvanized the minds of the government finally and very belatedly to say, enough's enough. We have to do something about this. Civil society worked with academia and with the federal system, the state systems, to come together in 2008 to put this plan together. This is Don Berwick, my former boss at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and who moved on to CMS. And he made this statement: "Some is not a number and soon is not a time." And what Don was saying, he was talking about the huge gap in the United States between the care that we deliver and the care that we could deliver. And it was prompted by the statistic that came out from the Institute of Medicine that 100,000 people are killed every year in the United States due to medical errors. So there was a crisis. So this was the conversation changer. But Don was saying something very different. He was saying, let's own it with a number. Let's name what that number is, and let's hold ourselves accountable by giving ourselves a time frame to fix it, because we have the tools to fix it. So the number was 100,000. The time was 18 months that he said, we're going to fix this problem. And then what do you do? Because it can only be done through collective action. No one group or person can do it alone. The South African government took this principle very much to heart. They defined the number. They said, we're going to get from, at that time they thought it was 21%. In fact, it was probably 10% at the time they made the plan. They said, we're going to get down below 5%, and they said that we're going to do it within 5 years. So a very clear articulation, and they came out with a plan to do it. I showed you what the plan was, a very sequential plan to rapidly scale this up. The second is that you need a simple system to apply the evidence. This is common sense. This is the path from the community to access, and then the steps that need to take place. The second is you need core measures to track the system. We had only 6 measures out of the 45 measures that were being used to collect data for PMTCT. There were only 6 that were ultimately used. I think there's a lot that's happening on the left-hand side of this graph in the STD movement at the moment. In South Africa, it took finally the president to stand up and say he himself was going to get an AIDS test, an HIV test, to really get the attention of the people. In South Africa, as I say, access to the clinics was not an issue. Huge issue in this country with regards to STDs. And this is really what I was talking about earlier. You cannot hand down these protocols into different contexts and expect them to work. Much of what I've seen in the programming of this conference is people like yourself who are working at the front line in different contexts and are gathering this very vital information about how do you affect changes. And that's exactly what we've done. And it has to be done in a systematic way. And measurement and data are absolutely key to that. And then finally, you need a strategic plan for scale-up. In South Africa's case, leadership intervention came a little out of kilter. You want typically to see leadership intervention starting and then a systematic move through demonstration, testing of scale-up, and then full national scale-up. I wanted to end by venturing into somewhat more shaky ground, particularly to an audience of people who know a lot more about this than I do. But I just want to tell you what I know, what I've read. So what I read is that the number of cases reported every year for chlamydia is about 1.4 million. And that is the highest number of any notifiable disease in the United States. Okay? That's a huge number. But what I also read is it's probably twice that, because we're only seeing what we see in terms of what comes to the clinics, and we're not doing a great job of measuring that. I also read that it costs about $700 million just to manage those tests and treatment. But probably the downstream stream cost is in the billions in terms of what happens to the undiagnosed women who go on to get PID, infertility, and loss of work, etc. Every system is perfectly designed to get the results it gets. So, you know, with chlamydia, we have those numbers because that's the system that's producing those numbers, and the only way to change it is to change the system. In 1993, national guidelines were put out that said every sexually active woman less than 26 years should receive an annual chlamydia screening. And we also know that chlamydia screening ranks as a top 10 most beneficial and cost prevention service. This data may be a little bit out of date, but still it's pretty shocking to see a line moving in a linear fashion very, very slowly, indicating that only about 50% of women who need it are getting screened when they actually, so these are women who actually turned up to clinic who should have been screened, and only 50% of them were getting screened. I know that there, in fact, is a lot, and there are probably a lot of people in this room thinking, well, we're really doing this. But I know there is a lot of good activity going on. I know I've read about the National Chlamydia Coalition, and there are some really interesting programs going on, such as the One Get Yourself Tested. There's some. I actually downloaded the app that allows you to see where your STD clinic is. So I think there's a lot of exciting stuff going on the left-hand side. These guidelines have been out, and I was amazed to remind myself that chlamydia treatment is really simple, a single dose of azithromycin, and then verify 3 months later to make sure that you're properly treated. This is, I think, the untapped gold dust that I think exists right here in this room, which is I think many of you are undertaking effectiveness studies that are yielding great information. This is a study that I heard about from Laura Douglas that's going to be spoken about later tomorrow about the fact that you've got to, if you have a woman in front of you, you've got to treat her immediately. You've got to give her the treatment. You can't expect somebody in that kind of a situation to go and pick up a prescription, because a third of them won't. So that's kind of obvious, but here's the data to show that that's true. And I'm sure that there are many, many examples like this. So what would it take? And here I'm going into even shakier ground. So say you thought about a national chlamydia campaign. Here's a number, 2 million. And one could say one would want to prevent it in a year. You'd need to get up to 95% reliability. In order to get that number, you'd have to activate, you'd have to make accessible, you'd have to get highly effective screening, treatment, and verification systems. The right-hand side actually should be very easy. Theoretically, and certainly the South Africans showed, 95% reliability for all of those over a much more complex, over 9 months. And there were mothers who were going back and forth to different clinics, and they were able to do it. That's number one. Second, a simple set of transparent measures that is fed back, that everybody is watching, that everybody agrees to, that can go back. And then thirdly, a plan, and a plan of where people get together and make this happen. And it's not just education. It's not just telling the doctors what they should be doing. It's an active plan that actually tracks the effectiveness of your intervention. There's this concept which many of you may be familiar with, which is common sense. It's collective impact. What it means, and it's particularly applicable in a complicated health system like you have in the United States, where you don't have a central organizing authority making a plan like you did in South Africa. It's going to take more than the federal government to do this. So a collective impact requires a common agenda, a shared measurement system, mutually reinforcing activities, continuous communication, and somebody prepared to pull it all together. the roadmap for large-scale change is very nicely laid out by John Carter, establishing a sense of urgency, creating that coalition, developing the vision, communicating that vision for buy-in, particularly in this country with its fractured systems, generating short wins, empowering a broad-based action, and then a culture change. There's a lot going on in the country at the moment, in a very changing landscape, which I believe has been the subject of a lot of conversation. There are opportunities, but there are also challenges. So the big opportunities is that there's expanded coverage. Millions of people who previously were not able, and it goes right to the core of the STD demographic, that in fact there is much more availability of coverage than there used to be. Free services are now covered under the ACA, particularly directed at STDs, both in terms of testing and in treatment. But the problem is that we have a fractured system. That system, the Medicaid expansion has been very uneven. STD clinics are shutting down, and the patients have a confusing array of options. If there is going to be collective action, it's going to be tough because you're going to have to get through to these different constituencies as well, the private clinics, the state-run clinics, and the federally qualified health centers as well. I wanted to just end by saying there are great examples already of collective action at a primary care level for some of these issues. This is a great example that Greg Randolph, who runs the Center for Public Health Quality, you can see this is the penetration of the counties in North Carolina. The only the non-colored ones are the ones that haven't undertaken quality improvement activities themselves. The orange ones are the ones that are active, and this is just one result that happens to be about hearing detection. And the point I wanted to make, this is not only can you across an entire state within 12 months effect a significant change, but it's not just a change in performance. This also saves money. Okay, so through using lean principles, they were able to show a 2-to-1 return on investment on the actual intervention, as well as huge savings for the community. And then an even more ambitious program under Michael Liu's direction at the Maternal Child Health Bureau, multi-state intervention to tackle the embarrassing issue of infant mortality, which I don't have time to describe, but goes to the core and uses exactly these principles. So there's precedent there, and the question is, what are we going to do about STDs, and can we apply these principles? And the answer, of course, is yes. Here's the playbook. We know these methods are available. Somebody has to step up and take these methods and apply them to the STD situation. Thank you.